from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Deepening economic and racial inequality, along with extreme weather caused by climate change, are making cities increasingly vulnerable to crisis. We'll talk to architect, urban designer, and social justice pioneer Carl Anthony about the steps we can take to make communities more equitable and more resilient in the face of environmental disaster. And in the hour, we'll also speak to Anthony's longtime collaborator, Paloma Pavel, about their work for Breakthrough Communities, a nonprofit organization that promotes sustainability and justice. That's next, after this. Welcome to Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. Environmental and social justice activist Carl Anthony draws on decades of experience as an architect in his new book, The Earth, the City, and the Hidden Narrative of Race. The book, part memoir and part tutorial, grapples with questions of urban democratization and sustainability in the context of shifting social norms and changing environmental realities. Carl Anthony, along with Paloma Pavel, his longtime collaborator with whom he co-founded the Breakthrough Communities Project, both join us to discuss their life's work and how we can bring about equity in a world threatened by climate change and social injustice. And let me, first of all, Carl Anthony, welcome you to the
Thank
forum.
You. Thank you very much, Michael.
Delighted to have you with us. And Pamela, Paloma Pavel, thank you for being here.
Thank you, Michael. It's great to be here.
So good to have you both. And I must say, I've known Carl for, well, I just hit the 25-year mark here behind the microphone. And I think back 25 years ago, he was here with me in studio. And
I think so, yeah.
It has been quite a career, and it's all mapped out in the book. Congratulations, first of all, on being what I would call unhesitatingly a pioneer in the environmental movement and a great contributor to it.
And Thank you.
I mean, you were really on the cusp before anybody with respect to environmental and racial justice, and we can talk about that. I want to talk about that with you. But we used to talk about, I remember having a conversation with you by saying, why aren't there more African-Americans like you in the environmental movement?
Well, we fixed that.
Yeah, you have fixed it, thanks to you, indeed. And the book is really a great deal about racial consciousness, about going back to Africa, about hearing Malcolm X actually lecture and all of that. I mean, it's sort of like your rite of passage.
Yeah, right, exactly. And it's been quite a ride.
Well, an amazing ride. And again, congratulations on that. I had no idea that you had done all this work in Africa, sort of deciding. Let me take you back, actually, for a moment here, because you're a graduate architect from Columbia and you burned your diploma.
Well, you know, it was a very kind of a physical reality. I was walking down the street with my cap and gown, holding my diploma, and I started to get sick. And I didn't really know what the issue was. And I got to my apartment, which is about two blocks away from Columbia, and I got sicker, and then I took out a match and burned it, and I felt a real great sense of relief.
Your mother was appalled at this, right?
Of course she was.
Tell us why you burned it, though.
Well, there are two conflicting reasons. I mean, Columbia University itself was a site of enormous disruption when, a week after Martin Luther King got shot, and some students were upset about the gymnasium that the university was building in the park. Some students from Harlem, and they occupied the president's office, and then eventually
this is a Strawberry Statement.
Yeah, right. And then other students occupied many other buildings. There were about five buildings that were occupied, and basically shut down the university for a month. And actually, my feeling about burning my diploma took place in the following year, but it was a pretty disruptive understanding, and there were many different dimensions of that. The protest against the university's treatment of the African-American community, which is right next door in Harlem on the other side of Morningside Heights, but there were also people who objected to the hiring of defense people for the Department of Defense at the university, and then there were many other criticisms of the university's policy about building, design and building. So there were, it was quite a complex event.
It was also complex in terms of your growing into greater awareness and consciousness, because you were becoming increasingly aware of the fact that black people had a great deal to do with not only the building of New York through the slave trade, but even the White House, and that there was a lot of African contributions, not only to architecture, but also African-American contributions to building and so forth, that had been pretty much out of the curriculum.
Absolutely. And then the other part of my feeling sick, I think, had to do with my my father, who I had been a very a good student in elementary school and in junior high school. And when I got to high school, my father decided that I should really go to a school where I could learn to work with my hands, because he felt that all of my learning would go to naught if I didn't know how to take care of myself. And when I went to Dobbins Vocational School in Carpentry, the faculty members protested and wrote a letter to my parents saying, I'm in the wrong department. I should be in the architectural department. And my father was furious. And so I think that I also had this really sense of betrayal of him by getting my degree in architecture. And so the confluence between my concern about Columbia University and its, not being able to lift up the experiences of black people.
Wasn't your father also a handyman for white developers in Philadelphia?
He wasn't really, not for developers, but for actually just individuals.
Well, those who were involved in building subdivisions,
right?
And my understanding from your book was that those subdivisions barred black people.
Well, the this was sort of at the beginning or in early stages of the suburbanization of the United States. And so the suburbs were being built as the people were leaving the inner city and moving out to the suburbs. So my father actually had originally been a butler for a very wealthy family on the main line in Philadelphia. And then he bought a farm and grew food for the people of Philadelphia during the Depression. And at the end of the 30s, the co-op failed, and he got a job in the defense industries. So he had a sort of checkered career, and he worked in the shipyard, Philadelphia shipyard, for 3 years, 5 years, until the end of the war.
And you were part of that whole so-called black bottom of Philadelphia.
That's right.
We're talking to Carl Anthony. He's here with us with Paloma Pavel. And Carl is now visiting professor at UC Davis, co-founder of Breakthrough Communities Project. Actually, Paloma's the founder, and we'll hear about that in a moment. Carl has a book out called The Earth, the City, and the Hidden Narrative of Race. Talk about when you went to Oklahoma. You got on a bus and you didn't realize Jim Crow was in effect.
Well, that was my first experience in the South. And we drove, the bus went through the parts of the nation that still had public accommodations that were in operation. And so we pulled into the station in the South, and there it was, white and colored on the doors and in front of the drinking fountains and so forth.
Well, this story of yours is really quite compelling. I mean, it's not only a story about racial consciousness and coming into awareness of being a black man in America and all that goes with that, but also distinguishing yourself. I mean, like James Baldwin did as an American. And yet you were very drawn to, I know you went to Africa. There's all this in your book about going through Mali and other places with your then companion. And seeing African architecture and learning a great deal from African architecture.
Well, it's really true, and there have been these long traditions. I first learned about that in an exhibition at the Museum of Modern Art. It was an exhibition called Architecture Without Architects, and I was really drawn to the buildings had been made by people all over the world without architects. And in Africa, the villages that were, I drove across the base of the desert in a Volkswagen bus and went and visited many villages all along there. They were quite spectacular, and they were made out of simple materials, mud and thatch, but they were profoundly spiritual. And that was really an amazing experience for me.
You also write about the relationship of African architecture to the environment and the roots that are not only anthropomorphic but androgynous.
Exactly. And one of the things that really impressed me a very great deal, in fact shocked me, was the buildings, particularly among the Dogon people. There were a number of villages across the base of the desert, and they each had a signature. I could really tell whenever I saw a picture later on of exactly where the buildings were, because they were all quite distinct in different locations. In among the Dogon people at the base of the escarpment there, the buildings were laid out in the form of a human being lying on his back, that form was repeated over and over again in all of the buildings, and it was also a signature that went from the smallest scale up to the larger layout of the town. And I was really surprised at this, and especially coming from New York, where everything is based on Cartesian geometry, First Street, Second Street, Third Street, First Avenue, Second Avenue, Third Avenue, First Floor, Second Floor, Third Floor. So it was really quite an amazing thing to find a village that was laid out based upon the figure of a human being.
Obviously it had enormous influence on you. Mm-hmm. Where did it all begin with you, I mean, in terms of your environmental work? I think, wasn't it they were making garbage dumps and incinerators in black neighborhoods that sort of got you really compelled before you even got to the Ford Foundation or David Brower?
Oh, yeah. Well, actually, there was this profound movement among African Americans who were protesting the siting of hazardous waste facilities. The United Church of Christ published a report called Toxic Waste and Race, and they investigated the siting of toxic waste facilities across the country, and they looked at the reasons for the location. They examined the educational, you know, ability of the people in those towns. They looked at the home ownership rates. They looked at their income, and they found that the most distinguishing factor that could determine the location of a hazardous waste facility was race. It could really go by whether it was an African-American neighborhood or, in some cases, Latino neighborhood that experienced the siting of a hazardous waste facility. And they did that across the country, and then they began to have public hearings about this and conducted these hearings in cities across the country. This was long before they really became a public kind of awareness. In fact, in the early 1990s, the Gulf Coast Tennis Association, that's from New Orleans, had written a letter to the 10 largest environmental organizations in the country protesting the fact that they had no people on their staff, no community involvement of African American communities, most of all, people on the boards were no black people or Latino people or Asian people on any of their boards, and they were presented environmental issues as if the people of color didn't exist. So they wrote this letter, which was supposed to be a secret. It wasn't really meant to be publicity, but it got published in the New York Times. And then from then on, the environmental justice movement exploded.
And our guest here in studio is Carl Anthony, who is really one of the, as I said earlier, pioneers of the environmental justice movement, an architect and social justice activist and author of a new book, The Earth, the City, and the Hidden Narrative of Race. And those of you who have followed the environmental movement, it's not only Carl's personal history, it's also really a history of the environmental movement, particularly in conjunction with working for environmental justice. And Paloma Pavel has joined in Carl's efforts. How did you two get together? Where did you meet?
Well, Paloma could probably tell the story, but we met toward the end of the 1990s, and she was working on a number of things that were I found quite interesting. Do you want to say a word about that?
Well, let's bring her into this. She's here with us in studio. And again, okay. Paloma Pavel is Carl's longtime collaborator and president and founder of Earth House Center, which we're going to find out more about. But how'd you two meet?
Thank you. We were co-founders of environmental organizations, the historic Urban Habitat Program, and my own organization, Earth House Center. And so we knew of each other's work, and I was very honored by Carl to be invited to actually do some training and development work, leadership development work with his own team internally in strategic planning. And at that time, I was also professor of organizational development and social change at the California Institute of Integral Studies, which was one of the first programs that really focused on the social change component of organizational development. So we've shared this passion for leadership training throughout our lives and our careers, and we'd been aware of each other's work. And
you've got a lot of focus now, on climate change and sustainability. I want to get into that, but let me back you up just a bit about the Urban Habitat Project, because it was really vested in a lot of multinational leadership for sustainable cities. That's what it was all about.
Well, actually, David Brower invited me to join the board of Earth
Island Institute.
I remember Island Institute. Yeah. And thank God I came on your program at that time.
You did, indeed.
I made a deal with him. I said, okay, I will do this. I'd love to do it. But my deal is that that Earth Island would sponsor this new organization that was dedicated to developing multiracial leadership for sustainable communities in the San Francisco Bay Area. Now, this was 2 years after the conference, that emphasized sustainability, where it became very popular. And so we started this program, and then suddenly we found ourselves in the midst of a grassroots movement across the country where many people have been working on these issues.
Well, let me go back to Paloma, though. I mean, there is a definite trajectory and connection here to what you're doing now, isn't there?
Yes.
Absolutely. It's one of our first projects, Carl and I, was the Smart Growth and Social Equity film that we created that was invited to be part of the Sustainability Footprint Project for the nine counties. It was kind of a predecessor of Plan Bay Area that's going now. And it was one of the earliest experiments to really bring in and honor the voice of communities of color who had been so left out of the planning process. So this film was actually quite an innovation on Carl's part.
Carl had long been talking about the fact that communities of color were left out of planning.
Right. And the innovation of making a film that would actually feature local Bay Area leaders in each of the nine counties was a brilliant idea. And what happened was, as people began their planning days, this film would be shown and was shown. And it provided both outreach, where many planners and decision makers on the urban planning scene were not aware of who their colleagues were at the community level, who were trying to organize from the ground up. So it was a place where the top down and the bottom up met in the middle, and there was cross pollination that was quite fertile and quite productive, both bringing in many, many communities of color into the planning process and doing it in a way that was on their own terms, so that they entered those days with themselves writ large up on the screen, shown as respected leaders before the day even began.
So the Breakthrough Communities Project begins to encompass not only this sensibility where others have to be inclusive and so forth, but you're really looking at the next generation. I mean, you've got statistics here about the effect of climate change. About 100 million people are going to be entering into poverty in the next decade, and that's been a center point and focus of your work now. Yeah,
yeah, absolutely. I wanted to just stress one other point. Planning in for African Americans is really a tragic reality that 5 centuries ago, the European explorers were planning for Africans to be kidnapped from Africa and transported across the ocean to work on these plantations. And they had to actually plan for how much space they would take in the ships, where they would, what kind of food, all these things had to be planned by the European colonizers. And they came to the New World in order to take over the land that was occupied by native people. And all that was really part of a plan. But the thing is, the people who were being affected did not really have a proactive role in shaping those things. So we have a whole long history of planning for African Americans that was not really visible.
There's a lot of things that aren't visible that you bring out in your book. I mean, I'm just thinking about what I learned from your book about Wall Street, about that.
Oh, yeah, right. This was an amazing reality. In 1991, when the United States government was planning to build a general services building in downtown Manhattan, they started to dig up the ground for the foundation, and they found some bones. And of course, they wanted to move forward really rapidly to get this building underway. But the archaeologists who were on the site said, well, we have an obligation legally to kind of work through. And, you know, Dr. Bevel, can you tell us what they found?
Well, at first they thought it was just some pottery shards. But as they saw the configuration of the bones and the artifacts, they realized that these were actually African slaves. And as more excavation went underway, it unearthed not just one or two, but hundreds and then thousands. And now the estimated size of that burial ground is about 20,000 Africans buried under Wall Street. And the name Wall Street...
Who built the wall? They came Wall
Street. They actually built the wall. And the reason the wall was built was because...
Keep out the Indians.
The Dutch settlers had run a massacre 2 days after signing a peace treaty against the Lenape Indians. Yeah. So in revenge, the Lenapes became furious and began retaliating, and the Africans were required to build this wall. So the wall that we now call Wall Street, that street proceeded to the Hudson where the slave market was, and the Africans were initially buried inside of Wall Street.
It was a huge outside. Slave market, too. It was the biggest outside of Charlottesville, which people
exactly.
don't realize. There's a lot of history in Carl's book, and a lot of opportunity to talk to one of the great environmental pioneers, Carl Anthony, who's here with us with Paloma Pavel. You can join us, and we invite you to do that. Our toll-free number, 866-733-6786. Please feel free to be a part of the program with any questions or comments. Again, you can join us now at 866-733-6786 or email us, forum@kqed.org, or go right to our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on the segment or tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum. We do welcome your involvement, so please feel free to be involved. And for all of us here at KQED, I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. Environmental and social justice activist Carl Anthony draws on decades of his experience as an architect in his new book, The Earth, the City, and the Hidden Narrative of Race. And the book is part memoir, part tutorial, and grapples with big questions about urban democratization and sustainability, especially in the context of shifting social norms and changing environmental realities. And as I started to broach before we went to that break, there are new estimates of climate change really affecting over the course of the next decade or two, thousands upon thousands of people who will be in poverty and will represent a new kind of apartheid potentially in terms of shortages of housing and trying to find integrated housing. Carl takes this up. He takes up a lot of stuff. He even takes up the Big Bang in his book. But you may have some wishes to enjoy a conversation that we're having by participating in it. There's a lot about African-American history and about Carl's own personal odyssey. There's also a lot about the connection between architecture in Africa and architecture here in the United States, particularly since the architecture in Africa obviously has a very different disjunction from the architecture here, particularly since most of that architecture was built, we find out, a lot of it at any rate, by African-Americans under white supervision, though there were slaves who even put the wall up with Wall Street and the White House and the like. I mean, there's a melding of so much history in his book, and we do want to hear your thoughts and do invite you to be part of the program, and you can join us at our toll-free number, 866-733-6786. I'd like to hear particularly from some of you who've been involved in the environmental movement through the years, or environmental justice and doing whatever you can about environmental racism. I'm sure some of you have some memories you'd like to share, and we'd like to hear that. Or you can also email us, forum@kqed.org. Carl's close friend and collaborator, Paloma Pavel, also with us here, president and founder of Earth House Center, co-founder of Breakthrough Communities Project, and they are working a great deal now on sustainability and on really doing something about climate change, which is an ongoing serious threat to all of us. Wonder if you'd say something, Carl, before we bring our listeners into this, about the fact I hadn't seen you in years, and you walked into the studio and had a cane, and I didn't realize that you'd lost your sight. It's been about 3 years. Talk about this disability of yours.
Well, it's you know, something came on about 3 years ago, and I have glaucoma, and it proceeded rapidly, and I didn't pay much attention to the drops that the eye doctor told me I should be taking. And suddenly I found that I was blind in one eye, and completely blind in one eye, and then shortly thereafter the other one went. So it's been about 3 years since I could see.
A tough lesson about need to listen to your doctor, huh?
Right, it really is. Any of you who actually have any eye problems, when they tell you to take drops, please take it. Take them.
And Paloma, what do you say in terms of our listeners? What do you want? That's a good personal plea from Carl, but what do you want them to know? What do you want them to learn and be apprised of, particularly with respect to the work you're doing in the environment now?
Thank you. As a transition, I'd also like to say that I've worked with Carl for 20 years, and in this transition, I see him actually deepening his focus and his visionary leadership, even at a time that he's losing his sight. It's also been a remarkable moment, I think, for really thinking about vulnerable communities in an additional way. We've thought about class, we've thought about race, and now it's really sharpening our focus about the impacts, for example, in any emergency disaster, to people with different abilities, and the challenges that that climate justice now needs to include with people who are blind or in chairs or other things. So we've actually been expanding and transforming our community understanding of disability and of vulnerability in the face of climate change.
That's great. Let me bring our callers in, and we'll go first to Tom. Tom joins us. Good morning.
Good morning. I am a Native American from South Dakota. I moved to the Bay Area decades ago, but I just noticed that it seems that Native American communities have been left out a lot of these discussions. I mean, for 500 years, we've been talking about sustainability, and I was just wondering if your guests could speak to that. A lot of the communities have been affected by toxic waste dump sites for decades, and a lot of health impacts. I just wanted to know if you could elaborate on that a bit.
Well, Tom, you're absolutely right, and I'm sure Carl or Paloma have some things to say about that. Carl?
Yeah, I would say that for a long time we've been talking about environmental issues, not acknowledging the Native people and not acknowledging the African people. But actually, one of the things that is really remarkable, and, you know, we've just been looking at the doctrine of discovery, where in 1492, the Pope declared that a line be drawn, and that west of this line in latitude would be given over to the Spanish, and the eastern part of that line would be given to the Portuguese. So the Portuguese got Africa, and the Spanish got the New World. Well, the truth of the matter is that not only was the genocide of Native Americans a central part of this moment of discovery in And many people protest and say it really wasn't discovered because there were people living here all along. But at that particular moment, the genocide of indigenous people in the New World and the enslavement of African people began. And it's been a remarkable turn of history that also included the colonization of most of the world. And although there's been almost no discussion of this particular period as an important foundation for our environmental movement, that many of the challenges that we now face have to do with beginning to realize the enormous transformation that happened beginning in 1492.
Which, of course, is the year America was discovered. It makes it even more perhaps plaintive to call that Indigenous Peoples Day rather than Columbus Day.
Exactly. And so, but I think it also calls on us to realize that since these small port cities in Europe began to spread out all over the world because of oceanic travel and began to take advantage of the peoples that they came in contact with. And that is an important source of our environmental problems today, which has to be really looked at in a larger global context.
Well, Carl, isn't Tom right about something else, that a lot of waste dumps and a lot of even radioactive places of refuse and the like were near Native American places?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And, but the tragedy also goes to the exploration that happened, for example, in the mountains of Mexico, where people were mining for silver. And they chopped down all the trees and created a devastating moonscape in order to be able to get the silver out of the mines. And ever since then, the siting of many of the hazardous waste facilities began to proliferate. And today, of course, most hazardous materials of plutonium have been buried in places that Native people are forced to live.
Or near their sacred sites.
And near their sacred sites. Yeah. So we have a huge history of these Native grounds that have actually been contaminated, most recently by the nuclear the processes of a nuclear, making nuclear bombs, and also some other uses of nuclear energy. So, and those places will be contaminated for centuries to come.
Let me thank Tom for that call, and we'll bring on more of our callers. Let me go next to OV. OV, welcome. You're on the air.
Hello, Michael. Thanks for taking my call. Yes, I wanted to ask Carl Klass a question about the underlying economic system, which is obviously capitalism, and some of the things that he described, the genocide, slavery, the environment, the underlying capitalism grew out of all of these things, genocide, slavery, the pillage of the environment, and now obviously it's the underlying issue around gentrification, environmental racism, the general sense that we need to move beyond capitalism to really solve these problems. We can't solve it within the context of capitalism.
Do you agree with that, Carl, that capitalism is not going to work?
Oh, man, do I agree with that. I don't believe in let's say an instant trashing of every invention that Europeans had made. I don't believe in that. But one of the things that I
wouldn't be able to get very far if you did believe in that.
No, we wouldn't. Right. But one of the things that I discovered in my travel to Amsterdam, we've been looking at the early history of Amsterdam in Dutch, and the Dutch West Indies Company, which was established in 1621, was actually one of the major, sort of in the middle of all of the port cities of Europe, that grew fantastically in those years of after 1492. We were led around the city of Amsterdam by an African, a group of Africans who had actually made a map of the impact of slavery on Amsterdam. And then we got to the main square of Amsterdam, and there's a big building that was the headquarters of the Dutch West Indies Company, which is now a major hotel and restaurant. And a stone throw across the square was the first international security, the first security building of the of capitalism. That in fact I discovered, Paloma and I were there, was that there's an integral relationship with the moment in which capitalism started to become dominant in the 15th and 16th century, was actually corresponded to the moment in which these places of domination, genocide, and colonialism and slavery was being established. In fact, where the money came from was land that was stolen from native people and from Mexicans, and on the backs of slavery that had been created. And it's really very difficult to actually untangle the knot.
Well, you get into these Genesis moments like 1492 and
exactly
one and capitalism's origin. And let me thank OV for his call. And Paloma Pavel, this is sort of tied in with the work you and Carl are doing now. It's a question from Claudia. She says, should people have fewer children considering the changes to climate and the impact of overpopulation? Is there a right answer? Mm. What do you say, people who ask that question of you?
Well, let's see. We certainly need to be looking at the footprint that we're making. And I think there's sometimes a blurring or a confusion between sort of population growth and resource consumption. So I think that's something that we need to actually pull apart and clarify. We're very much focused on the importance of sort of the next generation being really investing in our children. So we'd like to both look at how we as adults can become more conscious about our resource utilization, but also we need to think about the environmental literacy of the young ones coming up, because what we're learning is that some of the we have a number of programs going on in the schools right now. California has made an investment in their young people to have environmental literacy blueprint be part of the future of the curriculum in California. And this is actually a very positive investment in how we think about having children and how we think of investing in our children. And so I think what I would suggest is let's really think about the children that we have as our future, and also think about how we invest in them as a positive embracing of who we all need to be relying on going into the future. So we're excited about the intergenerational possibilities, and we're hoping to talk a little bit about that this morning.
Again, Paloma Pavel is the president and founder of Earth House Center and co-founder of Breakthrough Communication, a Communities Project. And here's another caller. John, join us. You're on the air.
Yeah, just one brief thought. I came from Germany. I've lived in 5 German cities. And everywhere I lived there, there was always, I could get everything, work, shop, in a commute within about a 2-block walking radius. They had multi-use planning everywhere. That was mandated in law. And also, as a solution to the housing problem, they built these giant towers. They're called Plattenbau. That was common in East Germany in particular, but also the West. So what they would do is they would design cities to be bike and walk friendly so they weren't dependent on cars. And that, of course, helps the poor considerably. So it's a lot of this has to do with how American cities are designed. You have these massive subdivisions here in Fairfield where I live, and they're unusable for the poor. So that creates also a lot of environmental problems with auto use. You could comment on that.
You made some very important points, John. And let me go to Carl Anthony. I mean, he's talking about urban planning and smart growth and all the rest of it, and there's a great deal of, shall we say, deficiencies in many places. Especially where the poor are concerned.
Yeah, I think that the the comments that are being made are absolutely right. And what we've discovered in looking at the way of building cities, and it's only been, you know, since World War II that there's been this kind of massive explosion of creation of whole new neighborhoods that were based on the suburbs and based on huge transportation infrastructure, mostly for automobiles.
And a lot of it was white flight. I mean, yeah, a lot of that planning was in the urban and suburban areas.
Exactly. Yeah, yeah. And there has been this... We're living in a really incredible moment in world history. And there has been this reaction against this kind of development. And so now we have a new reversal where people want to build and live in cities that are walkable. And this is also an example of how we have to begin to be much more intelligent about seeing the benefits of what is called a new urbanism or a new form of urbanism. But we also have to recognize that, you know, in the explosion that went before that of the suburbs, there was incredible racial kind of a racial attitudes that led to the development of all those cities. And now we're seeing all of those things being transported now in our new planning so that the concentration of people in walkable neighborhoods also, you know, people think of that now as places that wealthy people can go shopping while they're walking. In their neighborhoods, but the poor people who are now being pushed out to the suburbs where they are forced to spend 5 or 6 hours a day on getting back and forth from the city to the urban places, I mean to the rural rural and suburban places. So we have to think about planning for all of the populations in new ways, but we have to especially put our attention on transforming the environment that poor people live in, so that we don't have another generation of apartheid, this time turning inside out, where the poor people live on the periphery of our urban developments, while the rich people live in the inner cities, like is what's happening in San Francisco.
Well, we've got a caller on here. I was hoping that we'd hear from some people who were in the environmental movement back in the day and knew you and worked with you, and I think Robin is one of those. Robin, hi.
Hi, and hello, Carl and Paloma.
Robin Freeman.
Robin Freeman.
Yeah, I recognize your voice.
So I recognized yours also. But I wanted to give a big thank you and talk about some of the effect of what work you've done, because, you know, I've learned from you for 40 years now, and... we're now working in one of those marginalized former white flight suburbs in deep East Oakland, and with a grant or several grants to build a bicycle and pedestrian trail along San Leandro Creek that's community designed. And the opportunities built directly on graduates from Urban Habitat, sort of now almost the third generation, because your early graduates changed the narrative in Sacramento, and so finally there's funding, and it's getting to the city level where urban planning in the U.S. is actually controlled. But of course, all the institutions that built into it make it the default position to go just back to a nice real estate white people's trail through undervalued, you know, area, and would lead directly to gentrification. So we have a big project to invent how to actually make that cultural and asset.
It's good to hear about the work you're doing, Robin, and I appreciate your call. It might be a good time to ask Before we go to more callers, Paloma Pavela, talk about the work that's being done by Breakthrough Communities Project and what you envision and maybe how people can get involved.
Absolutely. What we're finding is that it's an amazing moment right now where groups that had been working in parallel, or the transportation advocates are getting together with the housing advocates. It's a time when it's a big coming home moment. And we're excited. One of the projects that we're working on is with the state of California on the environmental literacy project for the state. And the mandate to bring into that environmental literacy project in 1,000 school districts in California an equity lens, so that we see that it's not only environmental work linked to social justice, it's also linking to how we envision economics and how we envision work preparedness, and looking at careers, and young people beginning to see that they have a role themselves. Their own genius is needed on board now.
This is an ambitious project. How can people get involved? I'm actually getting some requests from young people.
Yeah, please contact us, breakthroughcommunities@gmail.com. 10 Strands has been taking the lead as being an organizing NGO in this, and we're honored to be part of the statewide steering committee of that. But if they contact us at breakthroughcommunities@gmail.com.
Okay, and let me get another caller on here. This is Sheila from Berkeley, and Berkeley is where early in the history of Carl Anthony, he actually fought the Santa Fe Railroad until they started to decide to hire more blacks. Go ahead, Sheila, you're on the air.
Oh, hi, Michael. So, number one, I just want to start with thanking you for a very exciting and optimistic program. We have too little optimism these days, and it's really important to be able to honor work like Carl and Paloma's. I wanted to also emphasize the Carl's new book, which the city, the Earth, the City, and the Hidden Narrative of Race, because reading it was really a great experience. It's accessible, it's poignant, it's insightful, and it relays a very special time. You know, the last 40 years of our history as we have reached this point, which is a very conflictual point, I have to say. I wanted to just mention very quickly an example of the kind of work that Carl has done over the years. As a brand new city council member in Oakland, not Berkeley, but in Oakland, I was introduced to Carl by Louise Music, and he spent a lot of time with me introducing me to the world of environmentalism and how it could impact our youth and how our youth could be involved. So, for an example, he introduced me to Mohammed Nauru, and we did a tremendous amount of work with him in the San Francisco League of Urban Gardeners. You probably remember that as well, Michael.
I do. Yeah.
Mohammed's now isn't he public? Public Works Director in San Francisco.
That's right. Willie Brown spotted him with his acute eye.
And hello, Michael.
You want to say hello to Muhammad? We don't know if he's listening.
Yeah, exactly.
But and was Carl a mentor of yours, Lisa?
Yeah. Well,
no, I just.
Are you asking me, Sheila?
Sheila? Yeah, I'm sorry.
Yes. Yeah. Yes, he was he was my mentor on environmentalism. He did introduce me. What we were able to do is bring the young people from Hunter's Point through Carl and Mohammed, bring them to Oakland and have them work in training our youth here in Oakland on how to establish an organization, East Bay Urban Gardeners, EBUG, and we established the community. We reestablished community gardens, working with the earth, and we. We were able to start looking at the work that they were doing in setting in entrepreneurial environmental projects. They set up a way that they could use the gardening and turn it into products. Like they had special vinegar, they had any number of different products that they produced. And so I use that as an example of how Carl's work has immediate can have immediate influence in the way this city operates and the way it can raise consciousness.
Well, since you're a mentee of Carl's, I should mention that, and you read his book, I'm certain you know that another mentee of his, Van Jones, wrote the foreword to his book. And Sheila, good to hear. Lisa, good to hear from you. Thank you for the call.
I'd like to just say something about Sheila, because I think, you know, she used to be the superintendent of schools in Alameda County, but she has put her life on the line to really reach out to the young people who have been in prison in the juvenile justice system that has really created such enormous problems for our communities.
We appreciate Sheila's call and appreciate the work that she's done. And let me say, since we're coming to the end of this hour, a lot of appreciation for the work that you two have done. And thank you so much for being with us. Quick word from you, Paloma.
Yes. One of the ways people can get involved is on March 10th, El Cerrito City Hall. We're going to be embodying the practice of bringing people together across many generations, across many sectors, with the film Tomorrow or Demain. Carl, John Gioia, Carrie Batha from Bay Carrot Conservation and Development Commission, Sheila Tarbett from Elders for Community Action, 10 o'clock.
We'll put that on our website. Thank you, Paloma Pavel. Thank you, Carl Anthony. And again, Carl, congratulations on the book. The book is The Earth, the City, and the Hidden Narrative of Race. For all of us at KQED, I'm Michael Krasny.